This is the Civic Roundup for Wednesday, June 21st, 2023, reporting on civic events in Asheville, North Carolina. Today's report is by Mark West, covering the Asheville City Council meeting of June 13th, at which extensive reports were presented on the system-wide water outages over the Christmas holiday of last year. Concerns with water pressure, lack of water, or discolored water began on December 24th, when temperatures fell, causing the water production facilities, filtration, and settling basins to freeze. The system normally would have been able to keep up with the water demand when the facility went offline, according to officials, but the winter storm led to numerous waterline breaks, depleting the system's water level. Overly optimistic estimates of when the restoration of service would occur, according to multiple sources, made under pressure from the mayor's office, led to confusion and frustration on the part of the public. According to reporting in the Asheville Watchdog, the city has a long-standing history of water woes. The origin of the city's rundown water infrastructure dates to the Great Depression and the mountain town's insistence on paying off a massive debt load. The city funneled every available dollar to repaying that debt, ignoring infrastructure needs and using water revenues to that purpose. The Depression-era debt was paid off in 1976. In 2022, an estimated 20% of the water from the city's two main reservoirs was lost to leaky pipes, and there were more than 720 boil water advisories in various parts of the city between 2017 and 2021, usually caused by breaks in water mains. The Christmas 2022 water system failure arose when an unusual cold snap broke 27 city-owned water lines and froze up the Mills River water plant, which the city relies upon to make up water pressure in such instances. After the city's ill-fated public relations response, the city decided to appoint an independent review committee to report on the event. Mike McGill of WaterPIO, a water system communication firm, spoke regarding the city's communicative efforts, which he described as including misleading messaging and its results. McGill pointed to a direct order and job-threatening pressure from Mayor Esther Mannheimer for the Water Department to say on December 27th that service would be restored within 24 to 48 hours, even though employees expressed concerns that meeting such a timeline would be highly unlikely.
The communications team was myself. My firm, WaterPIO, does this for a living. I led the after-action review for Austin, Texas, after the Texas freeze, where they had a boil water advisory for 1 million people because they lost water in their system. Rob Risley was on board to be the expert on emergency communications response planning, implementation, national incident management system, incident command system. And DIRT was phenomenal because Rob and I are not from here. So DIRT was on the committee providing a lot of information from the community to inform our work. And it is extremely valuable. Jade, obviously, can't thank him enough. Really made this process easy. A lot of tough questions answered quickly, so I can't thank him enough. Our process, in part thanks to Jade, we covered a lot of ground. We did more than 50 hours of interviews with members of the community, city staff, elected officials like yourselves, the news media, and I'd like to thank the news media as well. They were put in an interesting spot. I had to interview them for the committee work while they were covering our committee. So we came up with some guidelines and process to work with, and they worked with that process. So they really helped inform this work. So I'm very appreciative to them for what they did, because it was a unique situation. Community leaders, business leaders, impacted customers. I had a great conversation with my Uber driver coming in to the city about what happened. So we listened to everybody who wanted to talk to us. We had document review. We reviewed the comms and the emergency response plans as well. So what we want to start off with, and this is important for communications, I've been doing crisis comms work for 20 years now, is it's easy here in June to talk about what happened back then and kind of think, oh, gee, it's, you know, everything's perfect. At the time, it's important to discuss what everybody was dealing with, what everybody was facing, because it helped lead to the communications response that we saw. So I don't have to tell you how this happened smack dab in the middle of the holiday. Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and the day afterwards, which was a holiday for the city. So you had this impact right in the middle of that. And so there was a belief in our interviews, and like I said, we did a lot of interviews to come to these conclusions. We found that there was a kind of a hope, a belief that if the water main breaks that they found might have been impacting the system, if they were repaired, then this situation would not elevate to something of a serious nature like we saw. And that belief informed the communications. You had Mills River going down, which for any other system might have been one that kind of sprung, you know, to an emergency level, except for the fact that you had operated for months without Mills River before. So that past situation informed what happened during this situation. So it's unfair to kind of treat this as if it happened in the middle of a typical work week. So like I said, that hope led to the way the communications developed, what I call an operational approach to communications. And I've presented on this for the American Water Works Association at their conferences before, because it is an approach that we see all over the country of water utilities. The idea is, if you focus on responding to the crisis, the physical response to the crisis, then you don't need to potentially panic the public. And in this case, panic the public during Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and the day after Christmas. So the goal is you solve the problem with your system, and hopefully, and you have kind of managed communications that don't necessarily elevate to everybody we've got an emergency, with the hope that if you resolve the system problems, you don't have to put out those communications later. The problem with that is, as I'll get in more detail, is if the repair doesn't go well, then you're already behind the game on communications, and that's what we saw here. We also found the communication staff, they were on call during this event. They asked the right questions, but they did not have the training, and we'll go into this further, or the information about the water system where they could ask informed questions. You know, they had the basics covered of who, what, when, where, and how, but they really didn't have information where they could direct perhaps the water team to making some other informed communications decisions. So our key finding, like I said, that operational approach. You prioritize finding and fixing problems, your communications stay safe, and the idea is if you find and fix the problem, then the communications don't have to elevate, like I said. In this situation, because the repairs weren't made, because they couldn't fix the system, that approach to communications put them in trouble from the start. So when this elevated, they had to play catch-up. And that's the last thing you want to do with crisis communications. The approach also kept the water team in charge. And as we'll probably be discussed in Dennis's approach, you know, this didn't elevate to a citywide, system-wide, everybody all in emergency. It was managed basically by the water department and the city staff here. And because of that, the water team was in charge. So, like I said, their fallback was to work on the operational approach to communications. We discovered during the process that they had actually declared a major emergency on Christmas Day when it came to the demand that they were seeing in the system. But the communications that day were of, you know, we have an issue with our system, we need you to voluntarily conserve your water. So it didn't quite match up. And that was reflective of, like I said, that operational approach. What we always say, and it's kind of a best practice, is if you lose your water plant, you are changing the composition of your water for your customers. So that automatically elevates to an emergency notification to all. Because, again, they had operated for months without Mills River, it wasn't as much of a concern for them. However, as we've talked with the water team before, even a minor change in the composition of the water is one that you need to inform your customers about. You know, that is a public health safety concern. And it's not a Department of Homeland Security issue at all to say a water plant has gone down. This is what we dealt with in Austin, Texas. Their big water plant went down. And the emergency communications after consultation with DHS was, you've got to tell people that this water plant went down. So There was also a little bit of a confusing communication because Mills River wasn't named. It was kind of given as a directional location for the water plant. That was overuse of DHS, and it led to confusion, but that's an easy fix. What we also found was there was a lack of a proper crisis communications plan, structure, and process. You know, like I said before, being a crisis communicator, I use National Incident Management System, Incident Command System for crisis communications, and it works well. There's a reason why that structure's there, and there's a reason why it works all over the country on just about every emergency that you can imagine. It defines your communications process. And even if you don't fully implement the system, you can still pull the communications piece out of NIMS and use it on just about any situation. And unfortunately, that wasn't used here. If it was used here, if you did have that structure, there's someone called the public information officer. They report to only one person, the incident commander. That's it. They decide, they're in on every meeting, they help inform the communications, and they work with the incident commander to get those communications together and out. It's a very one-to-one process. And it's designed so that if you get, you know, with every crisis, you kind of get punched in that first 24, 48 hours. But after that, the goal is you get on a regular, consistent stream of communications. And that's what the process does under NIMS and Incident Command. And that you didn't have that here. And because of that, you had a process where there was a lot of people, a lot of cooks in the kitchen, if you will, that should not have been there under a successful process. You never got into that rhythm. The rhythm in communications kind of follows the news day. So if I'm in on a crisis, I'm informing the public before the morning newscasts, in the middle of the morning when decisions are basically made for the rest of the day, that informs the noon newscasts. Then you've got early to mid-afternoon before the evening newscasts, and then you got another update that comes in the middle of the evening to set up the 11 o'clock news, and then you just rinse, lather, repeat throughout the entire process. That's what you need to do in order to have successful crisis comms. The lack of the established process led to subject matter and comm staff recommendations being overridden by politicians. That's what happened here. They were not in charge of the process. They did not have final say in communications. They were producers. They were pushing it out. And that is not a successful process to use. We found there was a lot of distrust of the news media. They were not brought in early and often during this process. They were left kind of out at a distance. Yes, there were press conferences held, but that's not really how you inform the public during a crisis. They're helpful maybe once a day to give an overall view, an overall approach on what you're going to have that entire day and what you're going to work on, but they are not the number one path to get out communications. Like I said, it's that regular stream all throughout the day. So you don't have information gaps that confuse, you know, that are created that can confuse the public, where social media jumps in with false information. And so if you have that relationship with the press and you're working with them constantly, you get into that flow and you're informing the public properly throughout the crisis. But here, you know, what I heard from the press during my interviews was there was a reliance on the press conference approach, and all of their questions weren't answered. So they said, well, we get follow-up, and the follow-up wasn't as successful. And then those questions went unanswered in some cases. You can't really have that in a crisis. The water team, this is where Asheville Alerts come in. You know, I was looking at it from afar, and there was control over the Asheville Alert system. Normal process, the water team is the one pushing out alerts through Asheville, through your alert system, which is a perfectly fine process during a regular situation. You have a break, you have customers impacted, you put out some communications. But at a crisis level, they should not have been the ones putting out those communications. And Asheville Alert should not have been used as a primary communication vehicle like it was here. I built a crisis communication system for utilities serving 2 million people back in 2008. You know, it's top of the line. You don't use it as a primary communications tool. It's secondary. It's helpful. People have to sign up for it. And the people who tend to sign up for it are ones that are more astute, if you will, when it comes to communications technology. So you're kind of setting up information where it goes to kind of have and have nots. You don't want that in a crisis. So Asheville Alerts, which was a primary information stream here, should have been a secondary one. Then, and I understand this, this was common throughout the entire interview process, there was frustration over the fact that you could not give the public an accurate measure of who was without service. And I understand that. But your infrastructure doesn't really allow you to give that information. So the number was given, and this was kind of a group decision. There was not one actor here over another, where a decision was made to say that about 38,000 people were without service. The thing is, that number was based not in reality of who was without service, but how many people were signed up for Asheville Alerts. So that number was plugged in. It shouldn't have been done. But I will say, before, you know, kind of light them on fire for it, that number was high. So in other words, you kind of over-informed and overestimated the people who were without water. It still shouldn't have been done. However, it was not a public health concern because I believe you overestimated the outage. We had questions about the city manager and her involvement in the process. Those came from the media as well as people we interviewed. What we found and what Rob found, especially working through it, is that contrary to coverage, the city manager performed exactly as she should during this process. The city manager is not a spokesperson during a crisis. They are a facilitator to make sure the response is going well within the city, with staff, whatever they need, that's what the city manager does. But they are not a public face of the response to a crisis. So that was a misconception that we wanted to clean up. One area where the city manager was very honest and said she wished she had done better was management of the process, kind of keeping the communications to water and comms team versus allowing members of this council to come in and inform the information that was going out to the public. Because like I mentioned before, in a proper crisis communications process, that doesn't happen. Lack of crisis comms and trainings, water systems training, kept comms staff from fully serving in comms role. This is being addressed. This is, you know, I got a crash course in my first job in water in 2007. My utility went through 2,100 water main breaks my first winter. I got a crash course. That is the type of training and information you need to give to your comm staff. They were largely reduced to producers, not decision makers on comms, because of their lack of knowledge of the system and their lack of crisis communications training. Without NIMS and the incident command system in place, you didn't have quality control. You didn't have final approval processes where they were in charge. So they were left to basically provide input, but their decisions were not final. And you need that in this situation. In the case, this situation, there was a lot of confusion and information gaps created with who was informed on cancel, when, and how. You know, it wasn't even-handed. It wasn't a process that was set. So all of you were equally informed about what was going on. And that created a situation where there was political involvement in the comms decision and the messaging. This is not the best practice, especially in crises. You answer your questions. It is perfectly right and reasonable for you to express frustration and to ask questions about the information that is being developed and being put out. However, direct involvement in the communications, including final decisions, is not a best practice. All hands, the all hands on deck approach led to harmful delays. Communications that should have gone out in 15 minutes or half an hour took hours to be put together and be put out. And they kind of were kitchen sink documents. This was a complaint we got from the press that there was everything in the world in some of the communications that were going out. There wasn't really a focus on what is the key information you've got to get out in this crisis to the public. The second main focus of the report, this was the one that kind of angered me as a communicator before I even came on board. It was a communication that service was going to be restored on December 27th within 24 to 48 hours. And the reason why I was upset about it and talked to my committee members about it is because that's just not a communication that goes out from a crisis communicator on water and on the communications team. You just don't do it. In this case, what we discovered was that communications was put out, even though it was highly unlikely to maybe the nth degree that you were not going to meet that window of time. Tanks had not started refilling yet. The reason why this is elevated in importance is because I use this example with just about everybody I interviewed. This is the messaging. This is message that impacts public decisions on what they do during the crisis, how they protect their own health. If I'm told I'm going to get my service back within a day or two, I made some decisions where I was like, okay, maybe I can get through this. Maybe I can just find some water, sit tight, I'll be okay. If I'm told that it could last 4, 5, 6 days, it's a very different decision to make. Especially in my case, you know, I use this example, you know, my mother's 84. I'm making a very different decision if I only have to get her water for a day or two versus if I have to get it for 4, 5, or 6. So that was the situation and why it was elevated in importance. I understand the frustration that was expressed about the inability of the water and comms team to put out the information that the public really wanted the most. Who was without water when, or who was without water where and when they were going to get it back. I understand that frustration. However, you can't provide information that does not have the likelihood of being successful.
In other business, council approved a resolution reaffirming support of Asheville's LGBTQIA+ community. Before the vote on that resolution, George Swan Tuitt spoke in support of the resolution.
I am grateful for the city's affirmation of queer, and specifically trans, existence and difference. Compromising consensus can be difficult, and so, today, the council should be celebrated. However, because this statement only confirms that the city of Asheville rejects the harm and denial of the trans community and culture, specifically drag performances, there is much more work to be done. It isn't enough because the document fails to address the most frightening issue that motivated it, namely the mental state and physical dangers posed to the trans youth and teens in our time. It fails to offer a positive vision for enabling the wholeness for trans teens in Asheville. Recognition without action does not allow you to say that you aided the trans youth of Asheville. Enabling wholeness and doing right by trans teens in Asheville need not be difficult. Doing good can begin with very small steps, and I would like to briefly recommend an easy step forward. The City Council could vote to create a committee charged with creating inclusive spaces within Asheville schools. And this committee could include the very people at risk, namely trans youth, as well as people that can impact our lives positively.
Jonathan Wainscott also spoke. His comment was regarding inclusion of trans people in sports.
Just ran up here, I'm a little out of breath. Jonathan Wainscott, I think I was going to talk about the LGBTQIA affirmation, the consent agenda. And I just wanted to, real quick, this weekend, I wanted to give props to Austin Killips. I don't know if you're familiar with Austin Killips. She's a trans woman who just won the Belgian Waffle Ride, a bicycle race down in Hendersonville, and came in first place in the women's division. So good for her. I'm sorry for the second place winner who didn't get that. She won by 4 minutes, and then if she had competed in the male division, she would have lost by an hour. But I just want to thank all of these members of council for providing more places in this world for people like me, people with a penis, to compete and dominate, because that's what's happening, and the patriarchy thanks you for that. I think that it's, you know, there are a lot of people who are worried about women getting hurt in sports by the inclusion of trans athletes, and I'm not concerned about that too much. I did see the what was her name, Peyton McNabb. She has like an NFL name, and she also has an NFL style concussion. She's the woman who got hit in the face with a volleyball by a trans athlete, and everybody's like watching this video of this trans woman just skying and putting this ball right in her face. It comes bouncing off of her face so fast it doesn't even lose any speed, hits the net. None of her teammates picked it up. They got the point, and this poor woman was laid out on the floor for a minute, and now she doesn't have feeling in her face because she got so hit hard, got hit so hard that she's probably suffered permanent damage. But I don't care about that because you don't care about that. And so if seven sports-loving women aren't concerned about this issue, I'm not going to be concerned about it either. I would like to let you know that unfortunately it's 2023 and there are no tampons in the men's room, so I would like to maybe get that in the budget next year. I'm looking forward to having more places to go in this this world. I appreciate that. And for people who are concerned about gender affirmation therapy, this also applies to, like, you could have a boy who doesn't see his masculinity in his body the way he does in his mind, and we can give them puberty advancers, you know, and so a 10-year-old can become a grown man at that age, so they compete a little bit better and get that edge. So you're really doing a lot for people like me in this, and I really appreciate all that you're doing.
This has been the Civic Roundup for Wednesday, June 21st, 2023. Our theme music is by SP.